Investing Simplified is brought to you by Chuck Price, President and Wealth Manager of Price Financial Group, Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm. Individual situations will vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management. Chuck can be contacted by visiting www.pfgwm.com. You can email Chuck a question at askchuck@pfgwm.com, or you can call him right now at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now, here's the host of Investing Simplified, Chuck Price.
We do Investing Simplified.
Well, good morning, Portland, Oregon. Welcome to another beautiful Saturday morning. A little overcast, but the sun's coming out. Going to be another beautiful day. Hopefully, you've got something planned to get outside and enjoy the weather with. We'd like to welcome you to our show, Investing Simplified, where we have ideas about investing, ideas about legal, ideas about taxes. This is a chance for you to call and get your questions answered for free, and free is a good price. Give us a call at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626, and we have a couple lines open. My name is Chuck Price, President of Price Financial Group Wealth Management. We're a registered investment advisor firm. We specialize in investing by investing simplified by making your investments make sense to you. And like I said, we are here to answer your questions. You can go on my website also and ask questions or get information on there at www.pfgwm.com. I would like to introduce my co-host this beautiful Saturday morning. And first of all, Carl Jepson with the Warren Allen Law Firm.
Good morning, Chuck. How are you today?
Great. Good morning, Carl. And Kevin Sagi with the Baker Coastal CPA Firm.
Good morning, gentlemen.
And, you know, we've got a few little technical difficulties here, but I think we're going to get it resolved, hopefully. But if you do have a question, give us a call. We're here to answer those questions and hopefully give you some good information. I'm going to talk a little bit about give a little, I guess what they call a radio tease, but I'm going to talk about General Motors. And if you believe that when General Motors ran all those ads talking about their back, they were talking about building cars. They didn't talk that they were back, that they had paid off the government. If you believe they did pay off the government and you listen to all that hyper baloney they were spreading in those ads, you are sorely mistaken. And I'm going to give you some facts about General Motors that most people don't know. In fact, General Motors is still almost in about the same shape they were in when we bailed them out. And if you want to talk about that, you can call and ask me about it, and I'll be glad to talk to you about it. But I think one thing about Americans that we do, we are a great nation led by sheep, like sheep, when we listen to the news and we let these guys dumb us down. And we get dumbed down all the time on the news, giving a perception that something's one way, when in reality, it's the complete opposite. And I think it's time that, hopefully our show in the morning on a Saturday morning will get you to open your eyes and dig a little deeper into things that you hear on the news or you hear on TV or even on the financial station about companies. Because the interesting thing, of the 20 people that follow that stock, they're all recommending a buy on that stock when in reality it sucks. And that's another thing. Why would they do that? But on the other hand, a lot of the money managers of some of the top major mutual funds in America are avoiding it like the plague. So why is Wall Street pushing it? And the mutual fund guys that manage money for a living, that if they don't make money, they get fired. Why are they saying don't buy it? There's a reason, because the fundamentals are not there. And in buying an investment, the best thing I can tell you, and just like I said about Facebook when it came out, it wasn't making enough income to justify the price of the stock. And if a stock is not making the income and they have too much debt and they can't make money, that stock is not going to grow. It all boils down to money, to earnings. Well, I'm going to give a quick stock report here. And the market closed down. And as everybody knows, the market's had a really good run-up, but we kind of got slammed this last couple of weeks here. The Dow Jones closed at 15,081.47. It was down 30.72 points. But to me, the big thing is about the recovery. And again, here's another thing that every one of us gets dumbed down to when we hear the news. They're talking about this great recovery. Man, the market's turned. Everything's turned. Well, how has it really turned? If we go back, I want you to flash back to 10907 when the Dow at that time hit an all-time high of 14,164.53. Now, granted, we've blown through that numerous times, but if you look at the market as it closed Friday afternoon at 15,081, that means in that 5 years and 10 months, the market is only up 6.47 total return, 6.47. That means for the 5 years and 10 months, it's up an average annual return of 1.11. Now, if you think that's a recovery, I got some oceanfront property in Arizona I can sell you real cheap because that is not a recovery. The S&P closed at 1655.83. And again, if we go back to that all-time high back in 10907 of 1565.15, the market, the S&P, the 500 growth stocks, best growth stocks in America, is only up 5.79% in 5 years and 10 months. That's less than a 1% return. It actually comes out to 0.99% of a percent return for that period of time. That's terrible. In anybody's investment world, that's terrible. And you take a look at oil. Oil's starting to go up, and this is a concern I have. Somewhere, somehow, somebody in this country has to grab the bull by the horns and say, we almost are right now the number one exporter in the world in oil. And I don't understand why we can't start producing our own oil here, get refineries up and going, and get our gasoline down to a reasonable price, because the price is going to go up. And I mean, right now it closed at $107.95, up another $3 from last week. And actually it was up $3 and about 87 cents or 77 cents from the week before. Gold closed at 1368. Gold's finally taking a little kick around turn. But again, last week it was at 1285.10. Here's the one that's got me concerned. And Kevin, this is where I'm going to bring you in, because this is one of the things I think we need to be talking about, is about interest rates coming up. And as the Fed's realizing they have to quit printing $85 billion every single month, pumping into the economy, that causes a lot of uncertainty and concern in the market. And uncertainty is the kiss of death in the market. But the 10-year bond rate went up to one of the highest it's been for a long, long time. Went up to 2.89, closed on Friday. And just a week earlier, it was 2.58. It wasn't that long ago, Kevin, we were sitting here talking about the fact that it was under 2.
It was less than a month ago, I believe.
Yes, that's correct.
About a month ago.
Yeah. And you know, mortgage rates now, 30-year, are around 4%. And now, relatively speaking, Carl, in our lifetime, that's still a really low rate.
4 is still a really low rate. I can remember back in the 80s when we were double digits in mortgage rates. So.
Well, just remember that replay in your wheelhouse, because it's coming. We've done the same, you know, the old definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different results. Well, you take a look at our government. We've been doing this for 50 years. What do? We blow it up, and then we go through a tough period of time and have to readjust, come back, and then what do? We blow it up again, and that's where we're at. That happened in the late 70s, early 80s, and we had a period of time there for about 3 to 5 years that the economy totally sucked, and we're going to have another time like that. The unfortunate thing is, in my opinion, we've been in a long-term bear market. And years ago, Carl, we had a guy on the show come in and talk to us about the market, the upside of down, or the, you know, if you remember.
Right.
And we were talking about that, and he was talking about the long-term secular bear market. And that's what we've really been in. If you go back to 1999, 12/31/99, I can clearly show you with graphs exactly what the market's done. In fact, I have one report that starts on 12/31/99 showing that if you had invested $100,000 in an S&P index fund, no fees, no charges, no nothing, on 12/31/99, your $100,000 would have been worth $97,000. That's over a 12-year period of time. If that's not a bad bear market, I don't know what is. The problem is we've had 7 up years and we've had 5 down years in those 12. Now, if you go historically in the market, we have maybe 3 or 4 bad years and have 7 or 8 good years. When you have 7-5, that's pretty close. And unfortunately, some of those down years were pretty devastating. And when you try to plug in averages and you take a down year and you plug it into an average annual return, it exponentially affects the rate of your real return. Well, we're going to take a quick break and come back with Investing Simplified, and we're going to come back with Carl's comments. And if you've got a question, we have a couple of open lines here. Give us a call, 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. You're listening to Investing Simplified on a beautiful Saturday morning in Portland, Oregon.
The time to stop working is approaching, or maybe it's already arrived. CDs and money markets are paying only fractions of a point. How secure do you feel about retiring right now? Call Chuck Price. He's located right here in Portland, and he can show you how to increase your Social Security up to 67% using specific program rules and the file and suspend strategy. Chuck specializes in working with people who are either retired or are close to retiring, and he focuses on how to never run out of money during retirement. Do this today. Schedule a free 20-minute retirement plan phone consultation or schedule an appointment with Chuck himself. Call 503-253-3000. That's 503-253-3000. Chuck Price at Price Financial Group Wealth Management. On the web at pfgwm.com. Got a legal question? Coming up is Carl Jepson, estate planning attorney and partner of the Warren Allen Law Firm, with Carl's comments. You can call Carl at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Here's Carl Jepson.
And money. Well, welcome back to Investing Simplified. This is Carl Jepson with the Warren Allen Law Firm. And Carl's comments is the time when I talk about something in my practice that I think might be interesting to our listeners. And one of the things I've found over the years is, and it's becoming more prevalent, is the concept of guardianship and conservatorship. And so today what I thought we'd do is we're gonna figure out what they are, what they do, and why they're needed. I kind of wanted to start with why they're needed, because a lot of times people just don't realize where these people come from. And basically, a guardian or conservator is needed when a person, either a child or a person with a disability, has essentially what we call a legal disability. In other words, they have a physical or emotional or mental limitation that prevents them from being able to either manage their own financial affairs in the case of a conservator, or basically provide for their own health, welfare, and safety in the case of a guardian. And so that's why they're needed. And typically in today's world, you'll find that more and more of the baby boomers are getting older. And as they live longer, there's a larger number of them who find themselves in a disabled situation, either by dementia of some sort, Alzheimer's or other kinds of dementia, or other things that just make it impossible for them to either manage their own affairs or take care of themselves. And it becomes a very, very serious problem, and it's one for the courts now, because once you have a guardian or conservator, the courts are involved, and And as so many other government functions, the budget's just not there, and the court staff are overwhelmed with the work that they do now. And yet there are this growing number of guardians and conservators that are needed. So it presents a real problem, but I thought we ought to talk a little bit about what they do and what they are. Guardians are and conservators are court-appointed fiduciaries, and a fiduciary is a person who has the legal authority to act on behalf of another person. In this case, the person is called the protected person, or sometimes referred to as the respondent in the legal proceedings that appoints guardian or conservator. The difference between a guardian and a conservator is that the guardian is like a parent. The guardian takes care of the person's well-being, decides maybe where they're going to live, if they have to go to a nursing home or some other kind of care facility, and that sort of thing. Make sure that they have adequate medical care and take them to their appointments and the like, or make arrangements for that to happen. Whereas the conservator is a person who manages the person's finances and their property. This person's more in the nature of a manager, I guess you might say. And so those are kind of the distinctions of what they do, and as far as what their function is. It sounds fairly benign, but it can be a very, very difficult circumstance for anybody. And the level of dementia or the level of disability is somewhat different for every person. And so I'd like to talk just a little bit about what they do once they get appointed. Now, the appointment process is fairly exhaustive, and it involves a lot of paperwork on the part of lawyers and courts. There's always the paperwork. We are not a paperless society. Although, actually, believe it or not, they say that by about sometime next year, that at least here in Multnomah County and in other courts, it will be all electronic filing, which is going to be very interesting. The federal courts have already gone to mostly electronic filing, and so they're trying to make good on their paperless plans, but makes me wonder how it's all going to work. So it'll be an interesting ride for all of us. But going back to guardians and conservators, guardians, like I said, make decisions for people like they are children. In other words, they protect them from themselves, and that's basically what they do. Conservators, on the other hand, they have a lot more complex function because they have to manage money. They have to make sure that it is invested in a prudent way. They have to protect property if there's real property. They have to spend it wisely. And they have a significant accounting function. And that accounting function has to go to the court. So we've talked before about maintaining good records and doing all those kinds of things and exercising good judgment. And not everybody's equipped to do that very well. So, and it tends to be a thankless job. A lot of times, if there's a fight over who's going to be the conservator, you can almost bet that it's one of the family members who's more worried about their inheritance than they are about the well-being of their loved one. But not always, but usually that's what genders the fight, is that they're concerned about the money. And certainly the problem with guardianships and conservatorships are that they do cost money. If you have a professional fiduciary, they're going to charge fees. But likewise, no matter what you do, there are a whole lot of legal costs involved with establishing and monitoring a guardianship or conservatorship. So, if one can be avoided, it's great. Usually they happen when you have somebody who has some kind of disability, whether it's dementia or something else, which with a kind of personality that just refuses to be cooperative. And basically, they refuse to do things that are safe or avoid doing things that are dangerous, or they refuse to do things that are prudent with their money. And in those instances, that's really when you have a problem. And a lot of times, those circumstances warrant, I think, a paid professional fiduciary for a lot of reasons, because it takes that person out of the family dynamics, and at least as far as they don't have any emotional component to it. So those are basically some concerns about guardianship and conservatorship. My feeling is, too, that it's a very thankless job. For one thing, the protected person almost always dislikes the Guardian or the Conservator for a host of reasons. They feel that they've been put upon, and they've had their life taken away from them, and in a very real sense, they have. So there's a certain, you know, validity to that feeling. But nonetheless, it makes it more of a difficult job and a thankless job. So if you don't have a whole lot of patience and you don't have a lot of compassion for people, you ought not to do this kind of work. So basically, that's the main thing that we do about guardians and conservators. The guardian is the one who deals with the person. The conservator deals with the property. A lot of times it's the same person. You can have a combined guardian conservatorship, and that is more often the case, I think, in today's world. But just so that you understand, hopefully that helps you out, because it's a big deal. It's a very big deal, and it's something that you need to think about long and hard before you want to start looking into getting a guardian or conservator for one of your loved ones.
You know, the word fiduciary means somebody that's responsible for some delegation of whatever it might be. And I know in our industry, if you have a fiduciary responsibility to the client, that is that you do what's best for the client, not best for you or best for your firm, but what is best for the client. And certainly somebody who's helping a parent or anybody who has a fiduciary responsibility, I would think that fiduciary responsibility would be directly for the care and the welfare of the person, although in many times it ends up being the financial being for the beneficiaries.
Unfortunately, that's correct. In fact, I've seen over the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, a number of cases that I've actually been involved in where there was a fight that started over the various guardians and conservators, and what they were doing was they were really trying to get control of the money. You know, one of the family members wanted to, and in one of those, they actually got a bunch of money and left the state, and they're basically judgment proof, and so they basically took the money that was left in the family coffers and got themselves appointed guardian. We got them unappointed, and we got a judgment against them, but they basically just took the money. Now they're gone, and the money is gone. So that's why I said a lot of times if you have family members who, and they will all say, oh, well, I'm just doing this to protect my mom or my dad from, you know, Candy the caregiver or whatever. But more often than not, if you have a family member that's fighting with another family member, their interests are not aligned, and they're usually, looking to preserve the money for their inheritance.
Well, Carl, speaking about that, if somebody were to do that and they leave the state of Oregon and they go to another state, are there provisions in the law where you can actually go after them across state lines?
Oh, sure. We can seek to collect money from them by taking the judgment that was obtained and registering it in the other state and then going through the usual collection things. But in this instance, this is a person who has no money, has no real steady job, has no real property, has nothing to get. So, I mean, you've got to.
So they probably took the money and spent it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so you're not going to get it anyway.
But couldn't you, can in a situation like that, can you go down and press charges because they stole the money?
You know, they usually can. Generally, the district attorney offices and things like that just won't do that. They just won't look at it as a crime. They'll look at it as a civil matter, and certainly it's fraud. It's financial elder abuse, but most prosecutors don't want to get into that business. They've got so much going on with everything else that, you know, that one is a challenge. So you don't see a criminal charge very often.
Okay. Yeah.
Do you see many circumstances where someone who is under the care of a guardian or a conservator, circumstances change and they don't need that anymore, and then is that an easy process to have that reversed, or do you see that very often?
No and no. No, I don't see it often, and no, it's not an easy process. It does happen, and in fact, I've had several of them. The one case I mentioned about was where the son obtained a guardianship and conservatorship over dad and took his money. We got rid of that, him as a conservator, got a new conservator appointed immediately, and then thereafter, after a period of time, we're able to get the conservator and guardian, you know, terminated because basically what had happened was the son had manipulated the system pretty well in getting the guardianship established. That's not supposed to happen, but, you know, a lot of times there are people who are really good liars, and who knows more about their, you know, parent than their kid. And so, you know, it's an unfortunate situation. I don't think necessarily that happens all the time. I think most guardianships and conservatorships are warranted because there are some safeguards. The court sends out a person called a court visitor, and that person is usually trained, whether it be as a social worker or psychologist or something like that. And they go out and they interview. They essentially do an investigation, and they're a neutral party, and they try to do their best. Now, they're, needless to say, you know, they're still relying on what people tell them. And so if you've had someone who's out there laying the groundwork of manipulation, you know, sometimes they even get it wrong, and sometimes you have to go backwards. The process is very challenging because, you know, once it's been established, courts don't like to say, gee, maybe we made a mistake here, or they certainly don't like to go back and, you know, and redo stuff.
You know, we had a situation, Carl, that you were able to help us with a client of ours that they had gotten taken into the hospital, and they were totally depressed. And the hospital people brought in a conservator to take care of this person, not knowing that he had family and other people involved. And we actually went through the process to actually go back in and get that conservatorship removed and have a family member take over that fiduciary responsibility for the person. And these people had started out being a well-meaning situation where the court pays this guy to be the conservatorship, but it ended up being a little bit of a fight because we actually had to go through the process of going in and get that changed. And once we got it changed, this person got some help and actually got through their depression and became a totally different person the last 7-8 years of their life. And actually got to enjoy their life instead of being in a depressed state.
Yeah, sometimes, you know, there are all different kinds of circumstances and all different kinds of people, and we tend to see sometimes the worst circumstances. But I think that there are a lot of situations where family members do a wonderful job as a fiduciary. They, you know, it's kind of in the old days, you know, you tended to take the old folks in and care for them no matter how obnoxious or annoying they are. Those of us who are becoming older folks, you know, we're working on our annoying and obnoxiousness, but nonetheless, you know, it's just a little different. But you know, people who are caregivers in today's society, there's a huge number of them. And I read an article here some time ago about this huge number of people who are, you know, sometimes they're the sandwich generations where on the one end they're taking care of their parents and on the other end they're taking care of their kids. And so it's just this huge thing. So, and they make heroic efforts. The bad thing there is that sometimes they make such heroic efforts that they end up needing a guardian and conservator themselves because they wear themselves to a near-death situation.
Well, you know, one of the problems we have is getting our clients as they get older is to share with their kids their situation, their financial situation, get them to communicate with them so that when something like this comes up, and a lot of it is misperception because the majority of the people, and I would say 95% of the kids, all they really want for their parents to do is to enjoy their life and live out their life, and they spend their money, they spend their money. You know, there's that 3-5% that are just looking for the inheritance, but I really believe the majority of people are not that way.
I suppose so. I'm willing to go with a majority. I'm not sure about the 93-95%. I guess maybe I'm not. I'm just a little more jaded than that.
Well, you see more of the worst side than I do.
But you are right. I think that certainly the vast majority. I'll go with the vast majority.
Yeah.
Really do want the best for their parents and now that doesn't necessarily mean that they're really good conservators or guardians. You know, because again, it requires, you know, because they may be really busy. They may be doing their own lives. And it can be a really big job.
Well, we always tell our clients, you know, one of the things that I tell the clients, the kids of clients, when they get to that point, I say, you know, there was a great movie called Dirty Harry where Clint Eastwood always says, a man's got to know his limitations. And when it comes to being a fiduciary or being a caregiver, you better know your limitations, because it is a very tough job.
It really is, and I've often seen people who've come in and they've, you know, they're just at their wit's end because they're just exhausted. Really, they're, you know, and you talk about, if you're talking about a spouse and you're talking about an elderly person, well, you know, it's even that much harder because they're, you know, they don't have the stamina nor the vigor that they might have had, you know, 40 years ago. So.
Well, listen, if you want to give a call and ask a question about this, call 503-417-7626, 503-417-7626, and we're going to come right back with the tax investigator, and Kevin's going to tell us some great things about taxes and tell us how to hit a golf ball 300 yards. So we'll be right back with Investing Simplified.
When your legal rights and responsibilities are involved, you need attorneys you can trust. The attorneys at the Warren Allen Law Firm offer you solid legal advice and exceptional service. We practice in nearly all areas of law. We can help you with your legal needs, including wills, trusts, probate, contracts, real estate, construction, landlord rights, business, personal injury, divorce, bankruptcy, and civil litigation. The Warren Allen Law Firm has represented individuals and businesses for over three decades, and its nine attorneys have more than 200 years of combined experience practicing law. By combining experience and knowledge with individualized attention and prompt service, Warren Allen is the law firm to rely on when you are in need of legal representation. We are conveniently located at 850 Northeast 122nd Avenue near the I-205 and I-84 interchange. I'm Carl Jepson, partner with the Warren Allen Law Firm, and I invite you to contact us at 503-255-8795 or on the web at warrenallen.com.
Do you have a tax question? Here's your opportunity to ask the tax investigator, Kevin Stege, CPA and partner of the Baker Colson CPA firm. You can call Kevin at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now here's the CPA with the tax answers, CPA Kevin Stege.
You are listening to Investing Simplified here on a, again, beautiful Portland late summer morning. And Carl and I have been sharing a microphone here. So if the conversations seem a little one-sided, that's the reason. I guess we're like Tom and Jerry over here, or maybe Heckle and Jekyll or something like that. But anyway, we'll try to keep Carl involved.
Could it be Larry Moe?
Well, that's true. That's yeah. True. That's right. I didn't want you to be.
I guess
Larry,
I'd be curly. I got curly hair.
So yeah, that's right. Well, I don't know what to say about the 300-yard drive that Carl mentioned. Something about those who can't do should teach, but or something along those lines. But anyway, I that's not going to happen. At least, yeah. So let's go on to something a little more in my wheelhouse, like taxes. So in a recent case, a contractor who was working independently, an independent contractor, and maybe many of you have done that before or have done that on the side, and you want to know what can you take for your mileage expenses. Well, this recent case shows that the screws are a little bit tighter than they have been, or maybe you have done in the past. In a recent case, a contractor who his only business was construction work was not allowed to deduct the costs associated with driving between his residence and his various job sites. And you would think his home would be the principal place of business and his job sites would be going out in the field, and that mileage should be deductible. But apparently, he was not allowed to deduct these. He argued that his driving expenses should be deductible since the work locations were temporary, and he had other regular work locations away from his residence, such as his supply stores and his bank, but the court did not agree with that. They said that those work locations were not regular places of business, and that he visited them as a customer and not as a worker, and so they disallowed his mileage expenses. He would have been able to take his costs from his work sites to the supply stores, to the bank, transporting tools to and from, so on and so forth. So as you can see, things are getting a little bit tighter. I don't know how aggressive of a deduction he was looking to take. That could have been some reason why he was flagged here, although that wouldn't have any bearing on whether the court would agree or not. But do know that the state of Oregon looks at mileage fairly closely, particularly on hobbies or what they consider to be hobbies or side businesses. When you have a regular job and you've got a side business and you're showing a loss, you can pretty well be sure that they're going to be asking you for your mileage log, and you better have good documentation of where you went and why and what the business purpose was.
I always thought that would just be a standard deduction if you were going to a job site. I'm really surprised they would have denied that.
Yeah, it's the environment we are in. It's getting tight. So switching gears, we always like to touch a little bit on the Obamacare rules and little things that we are continuing to learn about that. One thing that did recently come out was the final regulations from the IRS on what of your tax information, what sort of information is going to be disclosed to Health and Human Services to help facilitate the decisions that need to be made, whether you're available to receive tax credits or cost sharing, as they're calling it. So that information that they're going to be disclosing is the IRS can disclose to Health and Human Services your taxpayer identification information, your filing status, the number of individuals for whom a deduction is allowed, your modified adjusted gross income. And interestingly, they added Social Security benefits, because if Health and Human Services just gets your tax information, they really don't know your household income. And so the IRS is going to help them figure that a little more by also disclosing the gross amount of your Social Security benefits to Health and Human Services. So
it sounds to me like they're setting themselves up to mean test your Social Security. And in other words, if you have a certain amount of other retirement income and you're receiving Social Security, that there's going to come a day when the government, because now they'll have be able to put all this together, they're going to say, well, Carl, your 401k that you saved and all the money that you invested, and that gave you $50,000 of income, and you really don't need that Social Security check you're getting, so we're going to take that away from you. That's kind of scary.
There is a lot of information that is becoming available for such things. One thing you may have noticed on your W-2s for 2012 was in box 12, there is a code DD, which was new for 2012. No jokes going
okay.
on here.
Yeah.
Code double D.
Yeah.
And that was to disclose the amount of your health insurance benefits that you are receiving from your company so that they can start tracking who is really paying health insurance benefits to their employees, and so on and so forth. So, I mean, that's a huge amount of information that they're receiving to determine what costs should be, that type of a thing. But it does provide some feedback to you, too, when you look at that and realize that, hey, your work has provided $14,000 of tax-free health insurance. That's a good thing.
Well, you know, as complicated as all that sounds, and as scary as, you know, it's one more step towards Big Brother watching you, I guess. But on the other hand, you know, we always are decrying the manipulation and fraud of various systems, including Medicare and stuff like that. Well, with the enhanced sort of computer capabilities that we have now, you know, they all have the same information. They all have cross-checked. So if you lie to one, you get caught by the other. I mean, you know, that's so. I mean, I suppose that's
the only problem is, Carl, that doesn't do a thing to stop Medicare fraud, because this is down to the individual, not to the companies and the hospitals and the administrators and the doctors that are committing fraud on Medicare. So it just goes to the individual taxpayer, right, Kevin? Is to the individual taxpayer. So you still got that overriding problem that's going on. It's been horrendous for a long time.
That's right. So moving on to one more topic here, and I find this very fascinating. This is based on an article written by Kelly Pope, and she is the associate professor of accounting at DePaul University. This is regarding one of the most extensive frauds that has been perpetrated in recent years. Just an incredible case that she does a very good job of detailing what happened and why it happened. And this is the unfortunate story of Rita Crundwell, who was a longtime employee of the city of Dixon, Illinois. So this is municipal fraud that is occurring. The city of Dixon has a budget of $6 to $8 million per year. So not a huge city. It'd be interesting to find out what the population was. But she was a longtime employee, and in 1983 she was named treasurer and comptroller. And as most municipalities have, they had their records audited by independent accounting firms throughout these years. In fact, they had several different accounting firms that had worked on their records over the course of this 20-25 year period. And she was hired in 1983, and in 1990, December of 1990, she opened a secret bank account in the name of the city of Dixon, and it was called the RSCDA Reserve Fund, the Reserve Sewer Capital Development Account. And she was the only person who knew about this account. Now, immediately, you can kind of see that something like this should have been caught. But as we go through here, we'll find out how it was not caught and why. And if you are a small business owner, I think this shows a valuable lesson of what you should do within your own company. Whether you trust your employee or not, when you're an auditor and you're looking for instances of fraud, you do not assume that a person is honest, and you do not assume that they are dishonest. And so if you have controls in place, those are just smart things to do. It is not an indication that somebody is a dishonest employee because you have controls in place. So it's just good accounting, good internal control, as they call it. But so in 1990, she opens this account, and in 1991, she begins writing checks to this account, transferring funds from the regular budget accounts to this account that she is the only signatory on and has the only control over and is the only one who knows about. She begins in the first year, 1991, she transferred $181,000 on a budget of $6 to $8 million. That's a fairly good sum to go undetected. And you'll see over the course of 21 years, this is small peanuts for what she did. Occasionally throughout this time period, she would be questioned by employees or leaders of the community about financial shortfalls. And her excuse, which she had a plausible excuse, was that the state of Illinois was late in making their payments. And it was known that the state of Illinois was as late as up to a year on making some payments. So But the problem was those were never followed up on and never looked into. And so raising the questions is a good start, but you got to do something with the answers. You can't just take an answer carte blanche. Another thing is that she was one of the most likable ladies in the community. She had a very good presence in the community. She did a lot for the community, and as you'll see, she had a lot of funds to help the community because of this. So here is a brief timeline, and this is frankly pretty interesting. So in 1991, she begins her embezzlement of $181,000. 92, it was $121,000. 93, she was up to $225,000. 94, 117, 95, 100,000, 97, about 320,000. 98, she starts getting aggressive, almost $800,000. And this is on a budget of $6 to $8 million. So she's taking up to 10% of the budget. 99, $1.1 million. And she's using this money to buy quarter horses, to hire employees in the city, to buy motorhomes that are extravagant vehicles. In 2000, she ups the ante, $1.9 million. 2001, $2.6 million. How is this going undetected?
It sounds like she got addicted to money.
And complete non-oversight. Let's see. So we're at 2.6 million. In 2002, it was 3 million. 2003, another $3 million. She reported a deficit of $1.3 million that she blamed on state funding cuts. 2004, she's up to 3.5 million. 2005, it's 4.6, 4.4, 4.75 million.
And nobody caught this in any of the annual audits?
Nobody's catching this.
Do they audit these municipalities every year?
I believe so. In 2007, it was 4.7 million for which she purchased a $1.9 million motorhome. A $2 million motorhome. Very nice. $5.8 million in 2008. That was the top of her. I mean, that's basically she stole the annual budget and it went undetected. $5.6 million. $5.6 million in 2009. When, in 2011, she goes on vacation and a city clerk opens the mail, discovers the account. The gig is up. She's arrested. She's charged. She's now serving 20 years in prison. So,
did she have to pay any of the money back?
I'm sure she'll be required to, but how's she gonna? $56 million over the course of 20 years is what she stole. The largest municipal fraud ever.
You'd almost think she was in Congress.
You're having too much fun with this joke. So the moral of the story is one simple control could have taken care of this. And that's the concept of segregation of duties. All they needed was one person to receive the bank statements and do the reconciliation other than her. She had control over all of that. Of course, she could have got that person to be in collusion for him for maybe a paltry, what, $5 or $10 million, and they could have been paid off. It's much more difficult to perpetrate fraud when you have to bring in other outside people.
You know, I guess we just assume that that municipalities and agencies would have these kind of safeguards in place already. I mean, you'd think it'd be standard procedure that you would automatically have people that do checks and balances, particularly when you're handling this kind of money.
You know, it seems to me that that this had to have been a relatively small city because that's really not a very big city budget. You know, I mean, Sandy and Troutdale and stuff have bigger budgets than that, and Fairview and stuff. One could wonder where their money goes to. But anyway, nonetheless, one of the features of really small cities is that they have very few people. And so they really don't do a lot of the things that bigger cities can do because they really have, you know, people wear many hats and they do it in a more informal way just simply because they don't have enough people to, you know, to go through the, you know, the structural kind of requirements that are needed. And they know everybody and they're, you know, everybody's a friend or acquaintance or, you know, and they just kind of, I think it's easier in some respects to get away with it in a small city than in a big city, just simply because there are less people looking.
Yeah, and they probably don't have the budget. You hate to say this, but they probably don't have the budget to have the extra people employed to check the balances, which is kind of funny, but not really.
Costly mistakes. So yeah, that's the tax investigator for today.
Wow. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back with the Investing Simplified with the Knowledge Trust. We're going to talk a little bit about General Motors stock. And if you own General Motors stock, give us a call. I'd like to talk to somebody who's bought it and what you think about the stock. And give us a call at Investing Simplified, 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626.
Hello, this is Kevin Stege, shareholder with Baker & Coulson Certified Public Accountants, serving the Portland and Southwest Washington areas for almost 40 years. We are a full-service accounting and consulting firm offering our services to a wide range of business and individual clients. One of the largest expenses to a household or a business is its tax burden. While off-the-shelf tax products can help file simple returns, they can't know your plans for the future and not only provide insight and planning to help you get there, but actually help you along the way. There are just some things that can't be replaced by experience. Whether you are just beginning your working career or have a well-established business with many employees, rely on the professionals at Baker & Coulson to help in an efficient, accurate, and personalized manner. We are located at 2414 Northeast Division in Gresham and can be reached at our website at bakercoulson.com or 503-666-5569. That's bakercoulson.com, 503-666-5569. And remember, at Baker & Coulson, our service is the product our clients remember most.
What you don't know can hurt you. Get that investing question or that legal question or even a tax question answered now. Call the Knowledge Trust at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now here's Chuck, Carl, and Kevin, the Knowledge Trust.
If I had $1 million...
Well, if you had $1 million, you might have been working for a municipality like Kevin was talking about and just had that go to your own bank account would have been a easy way to get $1 million. Of course, you might get $1 million might get you 20 years in prison. Well, listen, you're listening to Investing Simplified, and one of the things we want to talk about right now about the Knowledge Trust is next Saturday we're going to have a special guest on our show, Rodney Johnson, who's co-editor of Survive and Prosper with Harry Dent, the economist, and Rodney is going to be on our show for a half hour, the first half hour of our show, next Saturday. Unfortunately, Kevin's going to be running the hood to coast and out there getting some exercise while Carl and I are going to be here in the studio talking to Rodney Johnson and hopefully you. And this is an opportunity that I would suggest that over the next week, if you've been listening to our show, you know that we do answer questions, and this is a great opportunity to call in and ask a question of Rodney Johnson. And, of course, we'll have Harry Dent on, too. They'll rotate every month. But this is an opportunity to talk to somebody who is a highly recognized economist who writes on the economy every day, the Survive and Prosper. You can sign up for on our website at www.pfgwm.com, or you can go to harrydent.com and sign up for it. It's a free daily newsletter that comes with a lot of information and a lot of opinion. And opinion is probably what it's all about in economics, because you're trying to say what you think is going to happen or what you think isn't going to happen. And that's one of the things they do a lot of in there. But Harry Dent's had a pretty good track record of picking things out long term because he goes by demographics. And I want to just kind of emphasize here about demographics. Everybody talks, and we were talking at the start of the show, I was, about General Motors stock and the fact that we as a country bailed them out $49.5 billion of American taxpayer money, and so far, $32.5 million has been paid back to the American people, which means they still owe us $17 billion. It's kind of good news, bad news here. But that stock would have to go to $90 a share for us to get our money back. And I don't think that stock's going to do it. It's at about 37. And I, as I mentioned, 17 of the 20 top stock pickers who follow that stock are recommending that stock. In fact, they're given a potential $56 a share on that stock from 37 to 56, but it's kind of funny because all these stock pickers pick it, but then all the guys who run managed funds like Ng, John Hancock, MFS, Oppenheimer, Dodge & Cox, Prudential, Al Bernstein, AllianceBernstein, Wellington, and Templeton do not feel strongly enough about GM to become shareholders. So the guys who invest people's money to make money, and that's how they get paid, they're not buying a stock. So that's got to tell you something, because if the stock does grow, they'll make money, and of course their investors will make money. Of course, the one little problem that, you know, is the elephant in the room nobody wants to talk about is that the union pension plan for their executives and the union members is currently underfunded by $27.5 billion. That's with a B. So I'm not sure that stock's going to recover, and if it recovers, it's still going to have a monumental debt to be paid off. But sometimes what you hear, and the thing I want to emphasize to you is what you may hear on the radio and what you may hear on TV, on the news, and people are advocating. I know General Motors paid, I don't know how much money they spent on those ads saying they're back, but I wish they would have taken that money instead of paying for those ads and maybe paid it back to us taxpayers. I'd have been happier with that. And especially since their ads were blatantly deceiving. I mean, I don't think there's any other way you can say it. But I hope that stock does rebound because there's a lot of people who have invested money in it. Nobody talks much about all the bondholders who had bonds on that company when it went through bankruptcy, and they lost their money. So you haven't heard much about that. So that's my little bit on stock. Well, listen, we're going to have, like I said, Rodney Johnson is going to be on the show next week. So we're going to have a big show. But in the meantime, Carl, if somebody wanted to get a hold of you, how would they do it?
Well, the best way is to call my office at 503-255-8795. And if you wanted to make an appointment, you probably better ask for my assistant, Heather, because she does all that for me. And she says that I screw it up, and she's probably right. So that's the number. And we're located at 850 Northeast 122nd Avenue, which is one block north of Gleason on 122nd Avenue. And we are also available at warrenallen.com.
And Kevin, how about you?
We are located at 2414 Northeast Division, out the east side of Gresham. And our phone number is 503-666-5569. And you can find us on the web at bakercolson.com. And I do just want to say, this is a great week for you to sign up for the Survive and Prosper newsletter. Read some of their information, get some questions, and call in and ask Rodney because they've got a very interesting perspective, and information is going to help you in these next couple years.
Yeah, I think information is power, and knowledge is power. And the more information you get, if you just think about it, what they really talk about is the demographics about spending. And we all know the economics that a company's got to make money to make a profit. But what's more important for the economy to turn around, we got to have the younger people from 43 to 55 in that area. They're in their high earning years and have a large number of them out there buying and spending their money into the economy. And that's the problem. That number's dwindling because all those baby boomers that went through the cycle, many of them are still working and they've not retired, and those jobs are being held by them. And we don't have the big population coming through to follow up, to back it up. And that's why I think we're going to have another 5 to 7 years that are going to be tough. You can reach me at www.pfgwm.com. I'd recommend you go on the website. There's a lot of stuff there that you can get. There's also information on there about fiduciary, about how we look at fiduciary responsibility directly to our client. Also, you can reach me at 503-253-3000 during the week. And you can talk to Gail. We run our office kind of like a doctor's office. We kind of call it the financial doctor's office. And you call and schedule an appointment. And I also schedule phone appointments, and as I'm sure Carl does and Kevin does, if you want to just kind of get your feet wet and schedule an appointment with one of us and just kind of talk to us about what our procedures are and what we do, I'm sure that we'll be more than happy to do that with you. Again, tell everybody you know, next week we're going to have Rodney Johnson on the show. I think it'll be packed, especially with what's going on with the economy, how it's moving around. Rodney's got a very dry, witty sense of humor. He's a great guy to talk to. I've talked to him several times, and I think you'll really enjoy hearing his views on the economy. Well, this is Investing Simplified. Go out there and enjoy a beautiful day. And hopefully enjoy the rest of the weekend, because I guess the rest of the weekend is going to be absolutely gorgeous. So thanks again for listening to Investing Simplified. We'll be back next Saturday.